Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the newest edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and I have gathered four amazing voices who, if lunch that we had this past Saturday is any indication, and all the different ways that my mind was expanded and different experiences have now entered into my life, and I can't wait to continue this up. So if that's any indication, I think we're all in for a fantastic treat today. And to introduce our topic and sort of the genesis of it, I'm going to turn it over to our amazing Mormon Matters super guest, Joanna Brooks, to give us a quick framing, Joanna, before we introduce everybody.
Hello, everyone in Mormon Matters land. This is Joanna Brooks, Dan's occasional sidekick and perennial friend. You know, I was talking with Dan about podcast topics, and you know, it was in this year I've met via the internet some women whose work has really impressed me, and I wanted to get to know them better, and I'll tell you why. I grew up in Southern California, and in the area I grew up, there were Tongan wards in my stake and region, Samoan wards in my stake and region. I went to Brigham Young University. I had Maori friends, Tongan friends, Samoan friends. And yet I realized how little I really have understood about Mormonism, about how Mormonism feels and is experienced from their perspective, this substantial, you know, percentage of our church that are Tongan, Maori, and Samoan people. And so I've been thrilled over the last few months to come into contact with some brilliant women who engage Mormonism, who are deeply invested in their cultures. And I said, Dan, let's bring them on. Let's all learn a little bit more about, you know, people with whom we share our faith.
Yes. And boy, you were at the lunch Saturday and we learned a ton. And
it was awesome.
Yeah. And it's just going to be great. So what we're going to do, everyone, is besides just talking about their experience of Mormonism, each of them brings a social location also as from cultures that are bearing the effects of colonization. They're also at that, you know, in between spot between cultures. And I know in the case of one of our guests, especially, she is only half, well, no, both Gina and Luana, who we'll be introducing you to, are, do you guys call it half kase or?
Tongan term is hafe kasi, and it means half caste.
Okay.
I think hapa hauli also gets co-opted sometimes. This is Luana, by the way, that there's lots of phrases to refer to someone as half.
Okay, and so that's your standing and identity, and there's some neat things that you'll, not neat, well, they're neat in the sense that we're grateful to learn about them.
And informative.
Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that you're helping others embrace that.
So let's let them introduce themselves.
Yeah, let's just do it. Okay, so you all know Joanna and me. So why don't we go ahead and see how Gina's a veteran of our podcast of a few weeks ago. For those of you who, Gina Colvin has joined us again, and she, we all loved her on the race podcast that we did a few weeks ago. And Gina, would you just remind everybody who you are?
Hi, Dan and Joanna, Alapisi and Luana. Really pleased to be on this awesome podcast with these cool, cool people. My name's Gina Colvin, as Dan said, and I'm currently in Utah for about another 4 days, and then I go back to my home in Christchurch, New Zealand. And did you want some background, Dan?
Sure. Remind us again of your Maori background and your social location there, as well as what you do for a living, because not only are you experiencing it so many levels, your training is to really spot a lot of insightful angles on the dynamics.
Yeah, so Luana will introduce herself as Hafakasi, and Māori would say Hafakahi, but we don't usually use that now. It's more likely that we would identify with the ethnicity that we identify with. So I just call myself Māori. But my mother was of English, Irish, and German extraction, and her side of the family came out to New Zealand during the settlement period. And they were very strong Anglicans, so we've got strong Anglican heritage on my mother's side. My aunt joined the church in 1963, and then my mother followed in 1967. Now, the reason she followed was because she fell in love with a Māori musician who was, by all accounts, very handsome, and she was seduced by him. And he was a third-generation Mormon on his, from his both parents' side. My great-grandmother joined the church in 1935. That was because her daughter, my grandmother, joined the church in 1932, and then my grandfather joined in 1934. Now, they are their tribal location is Ngāti Porou, which is on the east coast of the North Island, and Ngā Puhi, which is in the northland of the North Island. So I grew up with my mother because my mother and father didn't stay together. She chose to raise me as a single mother in the church. So my growing up was really ecumenical. Like, my grandmother was Anglican and my mother was Mormon, and my Dutch nanny who looked after me, she was a Baptist, and my stepfather was Catholic. So it wouldn't be unusual for me to go to three services in different churches in one day, but I always maintain my Mormon identity. And yes, so my mother was always really, I think she liked brown boys a lot, in fact, because when she divorced my stepfather, she married another Māori. And she was really proud of my Māori identity at a time when it was unusual for anybody to be proud to be Māori. And she was very much encouraged me to in pursuing culture and language. But it wasn't until I was at university that I picked up the language and I became quite politicized. And I wrote my PhD, when did I submit it? In 2008. So I'm just kind of on the starting blocks. And on the early media accounts of Māori in the colonial press in New Zealand. And I called it The Soliloquy of Whiteness.
Wow.
Yep.
And so right now I work at the University of Canterbury and I work in critical pedagogy and cultural studies. So I train teachers to understand their cultural locatedness and to manage themselves culturally in different spaces. So that's me. And I have six children. I don't know if that would be interesting to your listeners.
All boys, and you told me boys are noisy.
Yes, yes, it's horrific. And I'm just here pretending that I'm not a mother.
Love it. That was so funny when you just started talking about never getting any peace because boys are so noisy. That was great. Too fun. Hey, well, thank you, Gina, for being on. We love having you again, and I know our audience is just going to really appreciate everything you share today. Luana, seeing how you spoke up a bit earlier, would you introduce yourself to us next? Thanks.
My name is Luana Uluave, and I am the daughter of Peter Uluave and Cheryl Uluave. My mother is Caucasian American, and when she was 19, decided to go see the world and thought a safe place to start was Hawaii. And when she arrived there, within just a matter of weeks, she met my father. He was a graduate of church schools in Tonga. There's a church school called Liahona, and scholarships are offered to students who do well there at the time to Church College of Hawaii. So my father was a new student there, and my parents met and fell in love at a time where Tongans and Haole girls were not encouraged to meet and fall in love. There are nine children in my family, and we grew up, I think, in different sorts of cultural spaces. That when I was little, we lived in Denver. No one had ever seen or heard of a Tongan. My father had no community, and his goal was to raise kids who could speak in good English and do well in school, and he did that. By the time my youngest brothers were in high school, my family had moved from Colorado to Hawaii and then to Provo. And my youngest brothers had a huge Mormon and Tongan community to be a part of. So in my family, different members speak different amounts of Tongan, identify as Tongan or American, more or less, depending on just sort of their own placement in the family and their own life experiences. I'm married to Jason Miller, who is a Palangi, who wishes he was Tongan. And we have three children. My academic background is I have a PhD in English with an emphasis on language, literacy, and rhetoric from the University of Illinois. And one of my interests is, Gina and I have just got to meet each other, but I got excited when she talked about what she does in the classroom, because the how pedagogy is affected by culture, by language, by rhetorical situation is something that's very interesting to me. And teacher education in that regard is something very interesting to me. I teach high school now for the most part. I teach at the Waterford School in Sandy, and I'm the debate coach, which means I also have a bus driver's license, which is
to get to all the tournaments. Yeah.
Skill. So I grew up in Utah for the most part and went to Provo High and identified mostly as the white girl in the family. The joke was that I was the white sheep. And it wasn't until college, and really even until the last 5 years, that I became really interested in knowing more about what it meant to me to be Tongan as well as American. And that was prompted by an experience where I was at a conference with some African-American women who were doing hair. And one of them asked me, you know, she said, "You're 40 years old. How come you don't know how to do your hair?" And I was just sort of struck by that.
Oh, honey.
All I answered was, "My mom was white." And right. They sat me down and kind of undid my hair, which, you know, it's curly Tongan hair. And I spent a lot of years straightening it with curling irons. And But that moment, the "why don't you know how to deal with your hair" question, really prompted me into looking more into what it means to me to be a Tongan and to claim that identity as my own. Now, the one other piece that's interesting is from the time I was about 13 until, through high school, my father was called to be the branch president of the Tongan branch in Provo. And so I spent my young women years out of the mainstream Provo church and in this tiny little Tongan branch, where I feel like I had a very different experience with what it meant to be a young woman and a saint, to be faithful, to be committed. And I'm very grateful for those years. So that's a lot of introduction. Is that good?
Hey, oh man, how exciting. There are so many ways to dive in with you, and thank you. And we're going to get to all those different pieces of you. So thanks. And I'm sure there's many more, of course, that you didn't mention. But hey, I was curious, and we could cut this if you don't want to answer it or whatever. Uh-huh. When you say your husband wishes he were Tongan, do you want to give at least 30 seconds on what that means?
Yes. Jason, how do you even explain? Jason has always so fully embraced Tongan culture in a way that helped me come back to it and be proud instead of embarrassed. That things that I would have hidden from my Provo High friends, I felt like I could share freely with Jason, and his response was always awesome.
Okay,
there's
cool.
There's so many examples of that, but the respect with which he is held in my family and the respect that he pays to customs and responsibilities and duties of being Tongan, it's not just, I love those people when they dance. It's that he fully understands that we have obligations because of who we are. And that willingness to embrace Tonganness in that way has made him, I think, a true Tongan in some ways.
Wow. That is beautiful. And a Pezi. And
yes.
A Pasi.
Yes.
Okay. Kaili, will you introduce yourselves? Boy, you've had tons to share too, I know. Go.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show today. I'm so excited. And just to be amongst all these awesome women, and of course, you, Dan, just really awesome for me. My name is Anapesi Kaili. I refer to myself as a transnational Tongan. And the reason why I say that is because I was raised both in Tonga and here in Utah, and I claim both nationalities, raised in both, you know, the American culture and the Tongan culture. And so that's how I identify myself, because I don't necessarily choose one over the other, although I will say that culturally I do lean more towards my Tongan side, you know, and it's just because that's how I was raised. But basically my
parents met at the Church College of Hawaii. They both went to school out there. My mother had received the coveted, you know, David O. McKay scholarship graduating from Liahona High School. And my father graduated from Atele College, which is a all-boys school. And they both met at the Church College of Hawaii, and that's kind of where, you know, where our family started. Both on my parents' side, both have a long history of Mormonism as Mormon pioneers on both sides. And so I was raised my whole life in the Mormon church, whether we were practicing it here in the United States or in Tonga. Let's see, I am currently finishing a PhD in education. I teach at the University of Utah. I teach courses in the Ethnic Studies Department that focus on Pacific Island identity, Pacific Island American experience. And I do a lot of work in our Pacific Islander community in relation to youth development, youth identity, youth empowerment. And so work a lot with our Pacific Island youth here in the state of Utah, and then also in various other states where we have large pockets of Pacific Island students or communities. And I run a movement that's called the Height Movement, which is focused on helping youth pursue emancipation. Basically getting youth to live their dreams. And, you know, it's in some ways it's cultural and it's also political. And so we get to do a lot of really cool things with our youth in the community. And I think that's it for now. And I think probably more will come up as we continue to talk.
Yes, and I remember one of the things that you shared with us at lunch is that because you were raised in both places, you're truly a bilingual, which in many ways for someone of your generation is quite unusual, and that has given you a really neat perspective as working with the elders who maybe, you know, only speak Tongan, or at least certain types of wisdom can only be shared in the native language, and you're
That's
just
right.
you're serving at this important crossroads. So we're so excited to have you. Thank you. Let's just dive in. As we were talking a bit in preparation, we decided that maybe we'd begin with, you know, as much as we want to get to your personal stories, and I know that they'll come out even through these early parts, but let's talk a bit about Mormonism and its origins in New Zealand, its origins in Tonga, and in the other Pacific Island nations. What was it that attracted people to Mormonism? Why was it successful? Why did it take root? And then what are the pieces of the Mormon story, Mormon scripture, etc., that sort of have, you know, become important within the different cultures that you come from? So, Gina, if you don't mind starting, we'd love to just get a lesson on New Zealand.
Okay. Well, it appears from my research that the first person to start talking about the missionaries going to New Zealand was W.W. Phelps. But they didn't arrive. I think he put it to Joseph Smith. It wasn't carried on. I think there was, from what I understand, there was some missionaries sent, but they arrived as far as Hawaii and didn't make it to New Zealand. And they wouldn't make it to New Zealand until about 1854. Prior to this, of course, the London Missionary Society, or the Church Missionary Society, which is the Anglican Church, had already sent out missionaries to New Zealand and had been well established for at least 40 years. Following them, the Wesleyans came along in 1823, and then the Catholics came along in about 1838. So they all had very active missionary efforts in New Zealand at the time that the missionaries came. Now they came, their missionary activities sort of kicked in about 1870, but they were only proselyting to the settlers, to white settlers, and established small branches around the country, a couple down in Christchurch and Wellington, and just some odd little places. But generally people would, if they had the money, they would gather to Utah if they were white. And so it was a case of bringing in converts and then as quickly as possible sending them back off to Utah as soon as they had the money to do it. So it was sort of on and off again. And then in about 1870, I think probably the first baptisms of Māori weren't until about 1883. And they came about, interestingly, because Māori, I think at the time, were irritated with the relationship between the government and with the church, and felt that in some ways they'd been betrayed by the Anglican missionaries. And many of them had already converted from animism and other sort of traditional Māori cosmologies. So they were already Christian. So they had this this tension with the churches that they'd established there, and facilitated by a number of really interesting prophecies by local tohunga. Now, tohunga were tribal local tribal college professors with kind of medical and genealogical and kind of spiritual skills. There were a few of them who had prophesied that the true church would come. And one of them most notably was in, well, actually there's a few of them, about four of them. In 1877, a chap called Apiata Kuikainga prophesied to his people that the true church would come and that ministers would teach salvation for the dead. And a man who was, in response to there being a Queen of England, was crowned the King of New Zealand, the Māori King of New Zealand, King Tawhiao, purportedly said that there'll be a sign given that the true church had come, because what they would do would be to write the names of men, women and children. And that was later on interpreted to be that they would take, they would have an interest in genealogical information.
Oh.
But the most profound prophecy, and this is the role of the tohunga to give prophecy, there's actually a word in Māori called matakite, which is to mean a seer. So they had all these sort of prophetic and revelatory and spiritual skills which were well entrenched in Māori culture when the Mormon missionaries showed up. And so a chap called Paura Paul Tangaroa said that, also gave a prophecy in 1881, and he was at a council with a group of chiefs in Mahia, which is on the east coast of New Zealand, and they were all debating whether or not what church they should go to. It sounds all very Joseph Smithian. Debating what church they should go to. And as the senior person, he said, I'm going to go away and I'm going to fast and pray about it, which he did for 3 days. And then he came back and he said a number of things. You'll know the true church because its missionaries will travel in pairs. They'll come from the rising sun. They'll visit the homes of the people and they will live with them. Now, this is something that the Anglican missionaries didn't do. They would always go and teach the people in their pas and their, you know, villages, and then go and find accommodation elsewhere. They would learn the language, which is something that the later Church Missionary Society missionaries didn't do. They weren't interested in the language. They would be interested in teaching Māori English so they could civilize them. They would teach the gospel, and they would raise their hand to the square. And so now this was...
This is some pretty specific stuff.
Very specific. Now, the thing was that they... They wrote this thing down and they call it a covenant, and they put it in a concrete sort of time chamber thing. But before they did it, a photographer came along and he took a photograph of it. Now, it wasn't until 1932, I think, when William Cowley was there, where they were talking about this, and a woman in the congregation said, it was the Ratana Church. Now, the Ratana Church was a Māori sort of Christian hybrid church. They had opened up this concrete block, but there were no remnants of the original covenant. They had all sort of aged. But a woman in the 1930s, she said, I have the photograph of that. And so she sent somebody home, and they pulled out this photograph, and sure enough, this was this thing that he said in 1881. Now, the missionaries came in 1883. And they came to that very congregation and obviously had all the signs of what they had been expecting in this very particular covenant by Paura Paul Tangaroa, and they all joined the church. So, so that's kind of how the church got established in New Zealand. And then it gradually became more of an indigenous religion, as and on balance, there became more and more Māori. And the missionaries, they learned the language. They translated the Book of Mormon into Māori. I think it was one of the first books of scripture to be Book of Mormons. Is that right? Books of Mormon or Book of Mormons? To be translated into another language. And then the missionary effort sort of proceeded from there and, you know, got quite a strong following among Māori. Currently now, though, Māori, the LDS Church is about the sixth most popular religion in New Zealand. It has about 1.2% of the population, which doesn't seem a lot because, yeah, it doesn't seem a lot. They're mostly, they're still Anglican. So that's the sort of, you know, the rough history.
Good, good. We could talk about it here. Maybe let's save it. And I know that there is some identification with being a Book of Mormon people and the Haggoth story and things that comes in. But maybe as our other two panelists talk about it in Tonga, you can kind of chime in on that piece of, you know, how you're sort of tying into the House of Israel and things like that. So does that work?
That's great.
We'll hold off on that. Okay, great. Anna Pacey, if you will do the same thing that Gina just did and sort of give us the Tongan story. And Luana, as we kind of talked about, jump in, add your pieces wherever you can. So thanks.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that Gina brought that up because some of the things that she talks about with the prophecies from the Tohunga was also used when LDS missionaries were proselyting in Tonga to show that, you know, this New Zealand is on board with this and they've converted to this, you know, and you guys are all kind of part of the Pacific. And so because Mormon missionaries didn't come into Tonga until 1891. And so a couple of years after they had been, and Tonga was one of the later places in Polynesia, because I think that they first started in French Polynesia, which was in Tahiti, and then kind of moved their way towards Tonga. And so in 1891 was when the first two missionaries, and every Tongan, whether you are Mormon or not, is familiar with their names. And Elder Smoot and Elder Butler, who came into Tonga who are part of the Samoa mission, and they were sent to Tonga to try and start the mission there, the LDS mission there. And so they came in 1891, met with the king at the time, but I think it's important to also note that the first missionaries who came into Tonga was in 1824, and they were Methodist, Wesleyan Methodist missionaries, and they really had already established a very stronghold in the island. In fact, in 1875 was when the king converted to Christianity, King George Tupou I, and then he also wrote the Tongan Constitution with the advice of Shirley Baker, who was a missionary that was there, a Wesleyan missionary. And the constitution that we currently practice now in Tonga is that same constitution. So they were very much embedded within the political landscape of Tonga. So, and then years later, you have in 1891, the Mormon missionaries coming into Tonga. I believe in 1892 was their very first convert to the LDS Church in Tonga. And then they were very unsuccessful in the sense that because the Wesleyan and Methodist missionaries had already had a very strong connection with those who were in power and with the chiefs and also with the people, they had already established schools and so forth there, that they really strategically made it almost impossible for the Mormon missionaries to do well there. And so they ended up leaving Tonga because they just almost really literally pushed out of there by the other religions who had already established themselves there in Tonga. And so they left, the missionary efforts in Tonga closed in 1897. And they left, and it wasn't until 1907 that it actually resumed again. And one of the things that I understand in the history is that they still had a very difficult time because they needed to establish strong connections with those who were at the top of the society, which were the chiefs, the royal family, and the Wesleyan and Methodist missionaries who had already, the Wesleyan missionaries who had baptized King George I, of course, basically had the hold of the royal family, which was, you know, huge. But one of the things that was established in the Constitution was that Tongans would be free to worship as they please, so a freedom of religion. And so when the missionaries went back in 1907, you know, the king couldn't, you know, turn them back. And so they ended up staying there in 1907, creating the LDS mission there, and then just started to build from there. And one of the first things that they did that they found that was, that really helped, I think, that established the presence of the LDS Church in Tonga was the building of the schools. And you still see that to today, as I mentioned, that the article that came out just last month showed that every single church, LDS Church school has been closed down everywhere else in the world except for Tonga. You know, and so those schools that were built, you know, back in, I think it was like in 1908 that they built the first schools in Babau, which is one of the main islands in Tonga, is still, you know, even to today, it's still there. And you have like different schools that are in different places, but Liahona being, you know, one of those schools that a lot of Pacific Islanders, a lot of Tongans went through that school, and that became their process through migration came through that school. It became the medium in how they came to the United States. So it's a very critical, you know, very critical in the sense of why Tongans migrated, you know, to the U.S. and how they came to the U.S. A lot of them came through, you know, the church school of church college in Hawaii that is now known as BYU Hawaii. And so that's kind of, you know, the general story or history behind the LDS Church going into Tonga. But from what I understand is that when they did go into there, they had a very hard time converting individuals. And one of the things that they had to do was they had to strategically figure out how they were going to bring different chiefs, you know, from these different villages, how they were going to, you know, convert them. Because one of the things that they found is that if they were able to convert the chiefs, then it was much easier for them to proselytize within these different villages. And one of the things that they did use was a reference to the Maori community and the individuals who were there, you know, who did convert to the LDS Mormon Church, and that the reasoning behind that is because of these prophecies that they had, and then also the connections with that, you know, with the Book of Mormon and the Lamanites. And so there was a lot of, you know, really setting forth a different precedence as to this is a religion that was created specifically catered toward you as Tongans, right? So you can identify with the Wesleyan Church or the Methodist Church, and, you know, and of course the Wesleyan Church and the Methodist Church, you know, were there longer, and so people saw that as part of the culture. But what they were able to do, LDS missionaries were able to do, was to show that through our doctrine there has always been a place for you that specifically was targeting you as Tongans or you as Pacific people. So look at your neighbors in Hawaii, in Samoa, and all of these different places who are joining the church because of this prophecy that happened many years ago, and that this book was created specifically for you. And so they had they did a really good job, and they were able to teach that in their schools that they created. And so they were able to get in, you know, from what I understand, they were able to, it was their way of penetrating that, you know, really difficult wall that was already there, that was established by Wesleyan Methodist missionaries. And then, you know, of course, you know, since then we have, you know, this large, you know, Tonga today is what, 46%, you know, Mormon. It has the largest, you know, member population per capita out of anywhere else in the world. So, of course, you know, it's completely grown into this big, huge religion there. But that's how it started. And eventually, as they were able to bring, you know, various individuals, you know, convert various individuals to the church, and then be able to, especially in Babau, establish very strong connections with chiefs there, which are, on my mom's side, is my mom's direct descendant from those chiefs who made it possible for many of those missionaries to get into Babau when they came back to reopen the mission.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Luana, anything to throw in?
I've got three things that I wanted to add. First, I want to emphasize again with Anapesi just how vital the education piece was for early missionaries and in establishing the identity of the church. that church schools and Mormon doctrine were always interwoven in the islands. And yes. People converted for religion, and they converted for education, that they saw opportunities for their children to study and to emigrate that they might not have had through other religions. A second part of, I think, Mormonism in the Tongan Islands is a strong reading of the Tongan people into the scriptures, as Anna Pessy points out. But it isn't just the Lamanite connection. It's, for example, in the Doctrine and Covenants, verse 1 of chapter 1 says, "Hearken, O ye people of my church, hearken ye people from afar, and ye that are upon the islands of the sea, listen together." And this was a direct invitation, I think, to the Tongan people. You are these people in the islands of the sea. And when the Doctrine and Covenants talks about that, when the Book of Mormon talks about the lost ones in the islands of the sea, this is you. And that understanding from the beginning of Mormonism is something that I think Tongans have found very compelling.
Okay, so you're saying, because Alma 63 about Hagoth really doesn't ever mention islands, so you're thinking 2 Nephi 29 about the gospel. And
the islands of the sea.
Yeah.
There's a couple of D&C verses, and this idea that the gathering of Israel includes a recovering of the remnant from the islands of the sea. That's very much inscribed in why Tongans, I think, are Mormon, and why they see themselves as Anna Pessy explained, as members of a church that was created for them and not just imposed upon them from other cultures.
Okay, cool.
The third thing that I did want to add is the constitution in Tonga is very, very amenable to religion. Everything in the country is closed on Sunday. The Sabbath day is kept by law. In the last 10 years, it's changed now that you can buy bread on Sunday night. Is that right, Anna Pessy?
Yeah, that is correct, that everything is closed on Sundays. Bread is the only thing that is, the bread store is the only thing that's open. And it was really more of a response to, I think it was the hurricane that happened in the 19, I can't remember the exact date, but because there was a need for it, it was a response to that. And so they've kept it open since then, but everything else is still completely closed.
So Tonga continues to be amenable to religion in ways that I think many other countries no longer are. That by law, all stores are closed. The only things to do are to go to church, to sleep, and to eat. There's now, I think, sort of an increasing black market on Sunday. You can go to the back of some stores and get what you need. But the whole feel of the country, when you wake up on Sunday in Tonga, it's silent except for church bells, and you can hear hymns kind of wafting from different churches as you walk down the street. And those are the only sounds that are present on a Sunday. And it's very striking how Sunday's regarded in Tonga, but I think it's one reason that Mormonism and all religions continue to flourish in Tonga in ways that they might not in other places.
Fascinating. So I mean, just one more question on that. No television and radio being beamed in, so people aren't even doing that on Sunday?
Well, you know, there are tourists now, and they're little off-island resorts where they might gather. My experience, I've only visited once, and from my experience, as I walked around, everything was completely silent, except for church music and bells.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, there are programs on TV, but they're church programs.
Interesting. Wow. So fascinating. Well, thank you, you guys. So you guys began to touch a little bit on the identification of the Book of Mormon peoples. Gina, let me throw back to you for the New Zealand Maori identifications. And when did that piece start to become part of the attractiveness of Mormonism, and, you know, how does it still fit within people's psyches today?
Well, there are two really interesting parts to that question. I think there was something in Mormon cosmology and the way they organized traditional societies in honoring things like prophecy and honoring the reverence for ancestors. And when the Christian missionaries came along, I think it was the Anglicans who first touted this notion of Māori being a lost tribe of Israel. Now, I'm not entirely sure exactly how that came about, but they later retracted it. But the, of course, when the Mormon missionaries came along, they said, you absolutely are the lost tribe of Israel, and they argued that Māori were descended from Lehi. Well, the people of Manasseh were descended from Lehi. And later on, when patriarchal blessings came to be given, people were giving, Māori were often given a lineage which was either of Manasseh or of Ephraim. And of course, if you were Manasseh, your lineage was through Lehi. And if you were of Ephraim, your lineage was through Ishmael. Now, it was really easy for them to hold up the Book of Mormon and say, as Luana said, say that, now where are we looking in the scriptures? Was it 2 Nephi?
This is the Hagoth.
The Hagoth, Alma, Alma 63, 7. It was easy for them to hold up the scriptures and say, you know, that chap, Hagoth, he was the one who came out and, you know, filled the islands with the people from Jerusalem. So, yes, it did. It had resonance because I think politically Māori liked this idea that they were the lost tribe of Israel. It gave them some authenticity. It gave them some kind of spiritual credibility. It gave them the sense that they were God's own people. And so that fed right into it. So I think those two things came together quite nicely. This notion of them being from the house of Israel, they've been set down by previous missionaries, picked up again by the Mormons when other people, the Anglicans, the Catholics, etc., or probably the Methodists, not the Catholics, dropped it. And then scripture was added to that to say this is how it all happened. So I think,
very interesting.
Yeah, I think the other part of your question is, and perhaps we'll go into that a little bit later, about where it sits now.
Right.
There's a lot of kind of ambiguity over that now.
And why is that?
Well, various missionaries, I think, you know, and it's very difficult to trace how this came about, but I know that Matthew Cowley, who was a very important missionary in New Zealand, and I think he served his mission then, and then he was called back and he served for 8 years as a mission president. He really reproduced that notion of Māori being of the house of Israel. It was just kind of taken for granted that, that's what it was. And that was kind of chased up in 1962 by Marky Peterson, who said the same thing. And then Hugh Brown, well, in the 1950s, Hugh B. Brown talked about Father Lehi being the ancestor of the Polynesian people. David O. McKay in the dedicatory prayer of the New Zealand Temple and the Church College of New Zealand. He also talked about Father Lehi. President Hinckley, I think he gave a prayer or a talk. He talked about there being two strains of the house of Israel. Ephraim, he said, was from Britain, and Lehi, the people of in New Zealand. There are two strains of the house of Israel. Ephraim represented, the British represented the strain of through Ephraim, and Lehi was the father of the Pacific peoples. And Kimball, I think, famously said, I'm not sure, maybe it was 1976 at the dedication of the Samoan temple, he said, you are Hagoth's people and there's no doubt about it.
Right.
And so by the time they started giving patriarchal blessings, I think that was really important too, because Māori came to expect that their patriarchal blessing would reflect that lineage. And of course it didn't. I think somebody, I can't remember when it was, did a look through all the microfilms of Māori patriarchal blessings, looked at 321 of them, and about, I've got the numbers here, 155 of those patriarchal blessings declared a lineage to Manasseh, 2 said Manasseh and Ephraim, 68 said Joseph, 62 said just Israel, and then 28 said Ephraim. So that's about three quarters of those patriarchal blessings were Manasseh, and half of those were Ephraim. It's interesting how that had an effect on relationships, because I know of a couple who were married at great resistance of their parents because her lineage said Manasseh and his said Ephraim. How is this in the islands if there's kind of a preferred lineage but there was great resistance to someone from Ephraim who apparently had the line of leadership marrying someone from Manasseh. So that was just, interesting.
Wow. Now you've told, again, like, the positive hits on why this identification's continued, but you said it's beginning to be held a little bit less, with less strength. At least that's what I thought you were getting at earlier, and I haven't picked up that piece yet. Why is it fading, or why is it ambivalent?
That would be a good matter for research. It's such an interesting question, because I grew up with this. I never knew anything different. And my elderly uncle still speaks with great reverence, and you know, there is absolutely no disrespect. He speaks with great reverence about his lineage and his connection to Lehi's children and the house of Israel. But I think I don't hear it as often. But I wouldn't, if I was in a Māori context, a Mormon Māori context, and there were elderly people there, I just simply wouldn't bring that up because it feels too disrespectful. Okay. But certainly, I think, was it in Elder Tanner and Maranji Romney drafted a letter in about 1972 because somebody wanted some clarification on whether or not this was doctrine, and they wrote a letter back to say it was just purely speculation and there was no scriptural evidence for it. But still, you know, I mean, I was born in 67 and that, you know, I grew up with this, so obviously that didn't have the effect of stemming the reproduction of that mythology.
And I think we may be hearing a de-emphasis on some of the House of Israel lineage tracing generally these days. You know, it seems to be something people of our generation, Gina, Dan, me, grew up with more. I don't know, just a hunch. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, could be. Now, I guess, Gina, one thing I just had, you don't think it's being de-emphasized or being held a little more lightly due to any of the critiques about DNA and the Book of Mormon, you know, with the Asian ancestry for Book of Mormon peoples and things like that?
I think so. I know for me, I wouldn't use that because, I kind of took classes in university where they talked about Pacific origins and it kind of rocked my world, actually. So it's just, there's just too much kind of ambiguity and ambivalence to sort of be sort of categorical about it. Yeah.
Okay.
However,
all right. Well, very interesting. Please.
However, I was going to say, as I said before, if in certain contexts and with a particular demographic, in a particular age group, if that would be what they would talk about, and that would be, you know, deeply, deeply kind of reverenced. And I wouldn't like to be the one to say, actually, uncle or auntie, I don't believe that. Because it's so important to them.
Uh-huh.
There's a Church News article from 1992 that outlines the official statements that were made that Hagar was a ancestor to the Pacific Islanders. And they span from, 1958 to 1976, including President Kimball, saying, "It seems rather clear to me that your ancestors moved northward and crossed a part of the South Pacific. You did not bring records with you, but you brought much food and provisions." That this was very much accepted church doctrine. My own personal experience is I wasn't aware of it until, as a teenager, an older man in the ward told me. He says, "You have a right to be proud of your lineage. Your grandma, she's from Hagar." And he told me some history, but it was very much something to be honored and to feel honored by, to be a descendant of Hagoth, and this was absolutely accepted as doctrine.
Very interesting. Yeah, Alma 63:6 uses the term much provisions, so there's a little code in President Kimball's words there. Okay, now it was interesting when we met for lunch, Luana, it was very important for you, at least you said in your family, that, yeah, your Book of Mormon people, it's Hagoth, but you were emphasizing Hagoth as a Nephite rather than a Lamanite, versus the things I had read in President Kimball's talks and things like that. It seems like it's generally thought that Pacific Islander peoples are Lamanites, and with the emphasis on, by the end of the Book of Mormon, the Lamanites were more righteous than Nephites. So that was sort of a way of, turning it on its head from, the typical white Nephite good guys, Lamanites, slothful, bad guys. So Tell me a little bit about the dynamic that made you react that way, or why you think your family's there. And I'd love to hear the others talk about does Nephite or Lamanite matter as long as it's Book of Mormon people tied to the House of Israel?
I'm kind of smiling right now because as you ask that question, I'm trying to think why I believe that. And I have no memory of where it originated, that I've just always known that Hagoth was a Nephite and that we are descendants of Nephites. But I can't remember if it was this man in my ward when I was a teenager or if it came from some other source. I'm going to have to go back and ask. Grandma Suave might have a thing or two to say about it. My guess is that she'll have something to tell me. Anna Pessy has met Grandma Suave.
We heard a few stories about Grandma Uluave at lunch the other day. I'd like to meet her too, Luana. Can you hook that up?
Goodness. She's so wonderful. But at church, she'll stand, well, not so much anymore, that as she's aging, it's more difficult. But over the years, she just is outrageous. She stood up in sacrament meeting at my brother's mission homecoming. And they told her to sit down, but she said, "I am Grandma." And kept talking. She made women in the ward, single women in the ward, stand up, pointed out which ones were Zion girls, and told my brother which kind of girl he should marry during church. And Grandma is permitted to do this. No one else can get away with stuff like that. But she had different Zion girls stand up. She talked about the length of their skirts. She told my brother, "This is a good Zion girl." She's very powerful and very opinionated.
Yeah, and later on we'll talk about matriarchy and the ways that women's roles have very powerful things, and that maybe is an area that the LDS Church does not penetrate. That's not a piece of the culture that it gets very far with when it comes to patriarchy and presiding and who really wields the power in the family. So I'm excited. We'll get into that later. But so the Nephite just sort of, you're not sure why it was with you. Gina, Anna Pessy, what do you guys, do you even worry about the distinction between Nephite and Lamanite as long as it's Book of Mormon people, or are you comfortable, or most people around you comfortable with Lamanite identity?
I always thought we were Lamanites, actually. And I wonder if it was because I grew up in that age of the Lamanite generation at BYU.
And President Kimball with his, Blossom Like a Rose and...
I think if we had to relate to anybody, like, I don't know about the Pacific Islands, but New Zealand is often related to Native Americans. So, of course, we imagined ourselves as Lamanites. And I'm not sure if that was doctrinal or it's just a case of the political situation with Native Americans being Indigenous and the political situation with New Zealand Māori being Indigenous, that we kind of connected. But I don't know. It's one of those mythologies that just kind of came to you. I never thought of myself as a Nephite. I was always a Lamanite. I was quite proud of it, too.
Cool. Yeah, and I would say the same thing. Like, that's how I understood it, was that we were Lamanites. But it was also, really strongly stressed that we were the descendants of Lehi. And so there was an understanding there that, both Lamanites and Nephites came from Lehi. And so, but I have always understood it as Lamanites. And it was something that we were to be very proud of. And that the Book of Mormon was, as I mentioned before, written specifically for us.
I do want to add, I don't want to overstate the Nephite version of Hagoth, that I think as a family, we always identified with Lamanite heritage as well as Nephite, that it's more important to be descendants of Lehi than to be a Nephite. That was, to be a Nephite is sort of a side note in kind of the larger discussion, if that makes sense. I don't want to overemphasize it.
Right. I think that came through well. Okay, this whole Lehi connection, Nephite, Lamanite thing, and of course we do have very positive formulations about Lamanites, but there are those problematic passages in the Book of Mormon that tend to equate skin color and righteousness, and they're the things that, listeners of this podcast and stuff, we're not sure what to do with those passages, because no one wants to think that those are inspired by God in the sense of, claiming that skin color is any kind of marker or whatnot of unrighteousness. So I would love to have the three of you and Joanna, from whatever you've gathered, because you've certainly, many people may not remember that your scholarly work is dealing a lot with Native American people and narratives.
Yep, it has.
So any of you, please jump in on this, but you've talked about positive things that the Pacific Island peoples have picked up from the Book of Mormon. Has any of this skin color righteousness stuff rubbed off and serving sort of as a cloud or as a negative thing? Or how does whiteness and lightness and darkness of skin sort of play itself out in your culture? So, Gina, can you tell us a little bit about how those passages are read and understood in, among Maori people?
Yeah, we discussed it at lunch the other day, and then I had my husband, who's got the Maori Book of Mormon, have a look it up and write me back. And basically it says that the Lamanites became he iwi porauri, which means a brown people, he iwi wiriwiri, which is like a horrible kind of people, and he iwi poke, which means to be kind of a dark, but more of a kind of a spiritually dark sort of people. Now, I was never particularly bothered by it growing up. I've always been quite proud of my skin colour and wished I'd been a bit darker. So it wasn't ever bothersome because, of course, the Lamanites became more righteous anyway. And so I suppose if you look at the overarching book, you know, story of the Book of Mormon, for us it was about the reclamation of sort of, you know, spiritual rights by a people that were considered spiritually impoverished to begin with, and their domination by a white race of, you know, people who kind of took their, you know, who oppressed them. Yeah, so that's the big story. It's like, well, yay, you know, the Lamanites got them in the end because they took their stuff.
I love it. I love it.
Okay. So the parts of 2 Nephi 5 is especially, I guess, the most difficult parts. So becoming a brown people, no one really emphasized that so much as spiritual darkness, sort of more spiritually impoverished. This whole that, you know, that my people won't be attracted. I can't remember what the language is exactly. I should have reread it. You know, it'll be a way to keep my people from wanting to intermix with them, their skin color and things like that. That just never really played out.
It only played out when Pākehā or Haoles talked about it. Amongst Māori, it's never been an issue. But when it's been kind of interpreted as a skin color, like skin color was a problem, it was a marker of filthiness, that was problematic. But we would sort of joke amongst ourselves. You know, people would hassle me for not being white enough. And I'd say it was because I was more righteous than they were. And, you know, there would be kind of, you know, laughter about that. But of course, if you say, like, people came brown and you're saying that to brown people don't really care. It's like, sweet. Be brown.
Gina, are there in your knowledge any uses where that scripture was used to shame in the history of non-Maori, Maori LDS evangelization, where that scripture was used to sort of shame Maori people, or, you know.
Never.
Right.
Right from the get-go, Maori, you know, a very kind of proud race, dare I call it, of people who are proud of their spiritual skills. The Mormons come along and say, hey, guess what? We acknowledge your spiritual skills. And it's because you're the house of Israel, and we're just going to give you the priesthood and the true church to embellish those. So Mormonism was always a very safe place to be Maori.
And easily indigenized.
Yes. And Māori very quickly became leaders in the church, and obviously took and were very much beloved. And we're going to talk about that later, right? The kind of sort of petted savages sort of thing. But very much beloved by the missionaries because they hosted them. They, you know, they lived in their homes. And the missionaries were very much at the mercy of Māori. So there wasn't, I don't recall ever there being somebody saying, you know, there is a problem with your skin color. And, you know, it might have been, yeah, like I said, it was just possibly just as a joke, but it was never used institutionally at all, ever.
Well, and I think it's brilliant, your observation about, you know, when that scripture is contextualized within the larger arc of this Book of Mormon narrative in which Lamanites, you know, defeat conquering and presumably self-important civilization of Nephites. You know, it just changes the whole meaning of that scripture to read it in that narrative arc. And I think that's just revelatory.
Yes.
I think an important distinction to understand, too, is that while blacks were denied the priesthood, Pacific Islanders never were. And that distinction, I think, at least in my experience, made Tongans feel separate from that condemnation of dark-skinned as being evil.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with Luana on that, because that was something that I hadn't really noticed that when growing up in Tonga, there was, you know, a reference to that, and it was read within a spiritual context, in the sense that it was spiritual darkness versus, you know, enlightenment in a sense. And I didn't really get the racialized discourse of that until I, you know, came here to Utah and started hearing it in wards that I went to that were predominantly white. And it was through Sunday school teachers or primary teachers who actually pointed out that kind of racialized discourse as something in relation to skin color. But I mean, growing up, that's not necessarily how I read it. And I don't believe that others that I know read it that way, but it is something that has come up more often in my work with a lot of the Tongan youth who say that they have heard that in their own wards, or, you know, have been stated to them, and which is why a lot of them choose to go to attend Tongan wards, you know, and so forth. And so I think it's become more racialized within our society because race is so endemic to the American society. But I don't necessarily remember it being that way or being read that way, you know, when I'm among other Tongans.
Anapesi, do you think it's fair to characterize it as a white people question?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Good. No, we're getting
stop
to something important
white
here.
People.
Yeah, okay, so this is big. This is big to hear it from you, and it's not, and you guys can just, I'm going to say something, and you can just tell me, you know, or riff on however I say this. There might be someone who would say, oh, how convenient that you just de-emphasize that part of it, but it's so clearly there. You know, that really is the dominant, you know, way that you're supposed to be reading it.
Yeah.
When you guys are saying, you know, we never read it that way. Our languages of our books of Mormon do not translate it in terms of darkness and you know, whatever the language there is there. Maybe the Tongan, the two of you who are familiar with the Tongan language, what does it say instead of blackness to come upon them or something like that? Is there a different word there?
Yeah, it references it as darkness. And so, but it's more, the word that's used in it is whakapopo'uli, which kind of refers more to a spiritual darkness, you know, okay. And so.
Obscurity, not to tone or color.
Yes.
And just for the wider listeners, I'll just mention really briefly, John DeLynn had Brant Gardner on his podcast on Mormon stories within the last 4 or 5 months. And this was Brant's reading of it. And I'm not sure that John at least kind of heard it as compellingly as it sounds like you and your cultures would have heard or sort of accepted Brant's reading of it. And so I just wanted to point that out. And for those, any of you who might have been, you know, persuaded by John's skepticism or something on that, you know. Joanna, are you laughing there?
No, that was someone else, but, you know, I can laugh at John once in a while.
And I think it was just probably something new to him. And, you know,
well, I think the thing I've gleaned from this discussion was, you know, both on Saturday, we're thinking about the different ways this term is translated in Books of Mormon across the world, to think about what we can learn from other translations, from decentering, you know, the English language version of the Book of Mormon and reading the tradition back through, you know, non-English versions of the Book of Mormon is instructive, but also decentering the racialized narrative that, you know, white people who read the Book of Mormon walk away with as a story of, you know, the fall of the great white civilization. Instead, again, decentering the perspective and reading it back through the eyes of, you know, people who aren't white, as, you know, as the Lamanites rising up and taking back, you know, something that they've been deprived of. So that, you know, those are great lens shifters that help. You know, I laugh when they say white people problems, because it's so important to decenter a Euro-American perspective on the gospel, you know?
The other question, though, is whether or not the use of these, the kind of soft use of these sort of possible skin color markers in the Book of Mormon was softened a bit as white missionaries translated the Tongan Book of Mormon and the Māori Book of Mormon, because they would have known, you know, look, their cohort who they're pitching to, if they looked at it as like a strong kind of color division. I mean, I'm just taking a critical look at this. If they kind of pitched it very harshly in that respect, then they probably would have, and made, you know, their potential converts feel as though skin color was a marker of their righteousness, then they probably wouldn't have got many converts. So I don't know. That's the other thing. But I prefer the decentering thing, Joanna. I think that's cool. Yes, let's decenter.
Let's decenter.
Woohoo! Decentering rules. Even
center, the epicenter of, you know, the white world church. I went to seminary at Provo High School, and I remember very clearly another Polynesian kid in my class raising his hand and saying, okay, this is about black people, this is about white people. And he said to the teacher, just so in this vulnerable way, he said, what about brown people? And the class laughed, and the teacher was so quick to jump in and reassure him, oh, you people are chosen people. This doesn't apply to you. And so even in the center of a place where that white version narrative might have been very strong, I grew up with a version where Lamanites in the context, especially Pacific Islanders, didn't count as dark and evil, that brown people are different was sort of the take that I came away with.
Excellent. You know, I've been promising a Mormon Matters episode about race in the Book of Mormon and in Scripture in general. And the curse language is fascinating to me in the sense that I think it's mostly, if we were to take the Jacob and Nephi as truly coming from the old world with sort of the values and the perspective of you do not marry outside the covenant, you know, outside the house of Israel. And if you allow for the possibility, which it seems like Farms and other Book of Mormon scholars are saying, they're finding hints that this was not an empty land when the people of Lehi came over on the boat. The fact that Nephi and Jacob are, you know, railing against the curse language, is at least railing against marrying outside the faith, outside the covenants. And so that's a way to, I'll just give that as a tease for something we may get into later in a different one.
It's easy to read those verses as saying, don't marry outside your people. And, you know, the index of that is skin color, but it's not the real question. The question is faith.
Yes, good. Yeah, so if and when we get to a Mormon Matters episode on that, we'll definitely revisit this, but I just wanted to give a quick tease right here. All right, you guys, I want to take us into what I thought was one of the most fascinating pieces, and also perhaps this is where a lot of tender feelings will perhaps surface, and that is sort of the experience that people, especially in your generations, have had, and just a generation older than you and things like that, of sort of having to perform indigeneity. Or how do you, what would be the right way to say that? You know, indigenous cultures, the Polynesian Cultural Center, sort of you're performing you're performing cultural dances and practices and things like that, but you're doing it for a white audience that has certain expectations, that view you in a certain way, that causes a sort of a confusion sometimes within a person's psyche about, where do I fit and things like that. So I just love us to dive in a little bit to the Polynesian. Let's just start with the Polynesian Cultural Center and this wonderful thing that everybody, you know, celebrates so often. It's not always seen quite as positively in your cultures.
I'll start if you don't mind.
Sure.
I went to the Polynesian Cultural Center and I got a work study scholarship. I think it was about 1984. Golly, I'm old. And my job was to work for 20 hours a week in the Maori village because they were short on authentic Maori. And one of the things that you find at the Polynesian Cultural Center is that a mark of cultural authenticity is just a brown skin, so that you can kind of be Tongan and you can be in the Tahitian village or the Samoan village. You can be Hawaiian and you can be in the Maori village. It's just, it doesn't really matter as long as you're brown.
Wow.
I was sent to the Maori village, and I don't know if, you know, many people may have been there, but you have a routine of doing poi dances and stick games and being kind of sort of indigenous informants for the white tourists. And I actually felt really demeaned by it. I was only 17 at the time, but I felt quite demeaned by it. And particularly in the context of BYU Hawaii, where there's a very strong honor code. I think your shorts needed to be down below your knees and your sleeves. It was probably the same today that it was then. But yet when we were over at the PCC, we were required to, you know, strip down to kind of native costumes. Obviously, we weren't nude, but, stringy sort of strappy things and short dresses. And in the evening performance, of course, there would be sort of seductive dancing and kind of kicking of legs up, up around, your ears. And I was very, very struck by that when you looked at the Haole girls who came over, they were kind of ready to get their clothes off, actually, to kind of get brown and, go sunbathing. But the Polynesian girls, my sense was that there was a modesty, and yet our bodies didn't seem to be worthwhile enough to want to keep them modest. So while we were watching, while all the Pākehā girls were able to keep their clothes on and, be of that sort of BYU sort of standard, the Polynesian girls, of course, were required to take their clothes off. And, that struck me that, perhaps my body wasn't as worthwhile and it wasn't as necessary for Jesus to preserve my modesty as it was for the white girls. So there was I felt quite demeaned by it. I didn't last very long there. It bothered me a lot, and it's just over the years as I've sort of tried to deconstruct it why it bothered me. It bothered me that I was performing cultural authenticity when I knew that that wasn't everything that what my culture was about. And it bothered me about how much money they were getting off us.
Well, right, yeah. Oh, I mean, your story is heartbreaking, this what you must have been feeling inside. And then I was about to ask, the money piece of it, you were being sold.
Yeah, I did a calculation of it. I think they call it the I Work program. And I'm not putting anybody off who wants to go to PCC, BYU Hawaii. And, in terms of being able to get to an international university, it's a very, very attractive option. But I think, their profits are huge. I don't think you get a ticket. You get a general membership ticket for about $50, but they average for around $100 each. They get, I don't know how many, maybe a million visitors a year. They have BYU students who, I think they'll get their tuition paid, but I think they're on about an average of $6 or $7 an hour. And I think for the kind of profits that they make, I think that's not particularly generous.
Oof.
Wow. Well, that is a great entry point to this. Let's go deeper and let's go a little bit more. Luana, you told us an interesting set of stories.
And my set of stories, I think, are much different than Gina's experience. My father worked at PCC, and over the years when we went back and visited, he'd point to the trees and brag. I don't know how much he was talking story and how much was true, but he would talk about how he was he'd climb the coconut trees and perform in the shows. And it's something that he recounts with great fondness and with pride. But more than that, it was the only way he could have gone to school, that every sacrifice in his family that could have been made had been made. And the reason he got to go to school was in part because he had family that sacrificed. He had other siblings who ended up never going to school, in part so that my father could. But because of his scholarship and his work at Church College of Hawaii, he was able to study. My dad he graduated from BYU Hawaii and then later studied at BYU. And he just retired last year. He was he was in the math department at Utah Valley University, where he served as department chair for 10 years and had a really satisfying career. He and my mom had 9 children who have all graduated from college, and this was his dream. So this place is the place that he remembers as the place that made his dreams come true. The other version of this that has been important to me is because I'm, the Palangi, the Hapa Haole, the American Tongan, a lot of what I know about being Tongan is not from direct experience. It's from reading or studying or visiting and trying to gather from other sources what it means to be Tongan. And these depictions in the Polynesian Cultural Center they're limited, they're simplistic, but there's something. And for someone like me to be able to go and show my children, this is a Tongan drum, this is a canoe. There's these legends about how the Pacific Islanders could drink salt seawater, and we don't know how that worked. Or this is a tapa cloth. You know, for someone to have a first introduction, you know, the Polynesian Cultural Center can play that role. If you look at the Wikipedia description, it's called either a theme park or a live museum. And I think both of those lenses are correct, that it's exploitative, that it requires the performance of culture in ways that are theme parky, but in other ways, it preserves traditional quilting, it promotes a sense of pride, and for some people, it's the place that gave them opportunities that they might not have found otherwise. So I don't know if I had a feel about it. I'd say my dad would say he was really glad he had his job there.
Fascinating and important. Thank you for adding those pieces to it. Maybe it wasn't your dad, but you told a story about being sexualized a bit, perhaps, when he's at work.
I had an experience when I was in Hawaii. It would have been, maybe 5 years ago. And we were just there on a family vacation, but out of curiosity, I went and sat in a Pacific literature class. And now someone was just gracious enough to let me sit in the class. I don't even remember the professor's name. But they had been reading about this idea of performing culture, of being caricaturized or exploited as cultural icons rather than as people who live a daily culture. And I don't even remember the piece that they were reading, but one of the reflections or one of the comments that came up in class was a student said that he'd been working the previous night. So it was a BYU student who worked at the Polynesian Cultural Center. And as you walk in, they put kukui nut lays on you and they take your picture and you buy it for $25 on your way out, right? But he was one of the guys that was standing there posing for these pictures. You know, and these are handsome young men that they, you know, they get them all buffed up and they're standing there in just their shorts. And so he's posing for this picture with some little old lady who's a tourist, and she reached behind him and goosed him right while they were taking the picture. And at the time, he said he just froze. He didn't know what to do. He didn't know how to respond. And he ended up just doing nothing. And I just remember being so struck by that story that he commented, I can read it in class and see the problem, but when I went to work, I didn't know what to do.
Wow. Yeah, his job in part depended upon not overreacting, but certainly that internal stuff going on, similar a little bit to what Gina was talking about.
And I don't know him, you know, again, I didn't know his name, but there was this laugh of recognition in the class where other people in the class expressed the same sort of experience. I don't know if that was that bold, but when he expressed what had happened, it was to a group who understood because they'd had similar experiences.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing. Anapesi, I want to include you to say whatever you would like about the Polynesian Cultural Center or experiences or you know, anything that you've come up with. But we could also use this moment to transition into another sort of moment in this history of Mormonism intersecting with Islander peoples and things like that. The movie The Other Side of Heaven, based upon John Groberg's missionary experiences and a book that he sold the rights to and a film was made. But again, start with the PCC if you'd like, or start there. But this whole connection that we're kind of getting to of the sexualization or the link between Polynesian cultures and sexuality in general, might be an interesting place to go next. So you take us however you want to go into that area.
Yeah, I want to make two comments about PCC. First of all, as I mentioned before, both of my parents attended school there and graduated from there. They didn't have to dance. They were on a different kind of scholarship, so they didn't ever experience having to dance at the Polynesian Cultural Center, but, you know, did tell us stories about relatives, aunties of ours who did. And also, I mean, one of the things that's really interesting about it is that I grew up, the way that I understood dancing and the way that I was raised was that it was not a form of entertainment, right? And so when we danced at specific, if it was for a relative or a birthday or something, there was a specific purpose why that dance was being performed, and it wasn't something that was related to entertainment. So that was something that really kind of threw me off when, you know, in watching it and, you know, being able to go back and forth between Dongan here in the United States, is to see how it was looked at specifically as a form of entertainment by those who were not from the Pacific. And one of the things that I struggle with all the time is that we get so many calls. I get so many calls. I can't even tell you how many times people have called me from different wards who are doing luaus here in Utah. And they're always requesting dancers. And there's always a reference to the Polynesian Culture Center. I heard that you work with youth. Will they be able to come and dance? Can you guys do what they do at the Polynesian Cultural Center? And so there is already this image of what, you know, Pacific Island culture is, and it's so tied to dancing and entertainment. And for a lot of them, their reference point is the Polynesian Cultural Center. And I get it all the time with students who come into my class who are taking a Pacific Islander course, who are shocked and surprised that we're talking about history and colonialism and racism and all of these things, whereas they expected it to be something similar to the Polynesian Cultural Center. And so, you know, constantly going up, you know, against this, you know, this representation of who Pacific Islanders are, what they look like, or how they should respond, or, you know, that dancing is always something that is for entertainment, which is not how I was raised and not how I understood it. And I mean, it wasn't until later that I did see, like, you know, the role of dancing and how that was looked at.
But do you mind me asking, how do you respond to those who call you? And, you know, even, you know, if you point them to people who do, you know, do they have a business of, you know, providing these dancers and whatnot? Can you tell us?
Yes, you know, Dan, it really depends on the day. If I am in a really, good mood, I will refer them to a Pacific Islander dance group. If I'm not in the good mood, I simply just say no, I don't know, and just leave it at that. You know, and because
so, never like a moment of education.
I'm inundated with these, you know.
She's tired, man. She's running a worldwide movement to, like, up, you know, graduation rates among Pacific youth and fight, you know, stereotypes. She's tired. She doesn't have time to be fielding our phone calls for entertainment.
Yeah, it's so, she's I mean, tired. Really, yeah, it does really depend on how I'm feeling, and because we get so many of those calls, you know, and one of the things that's so interesting is that students, you know, it was kind of controversial in the sense that some of my students at the University of Utah have, like, taken a stand to say, we will not dance at luaus, we will not perform at luaus, we will not do luaus. And it was mixed, you know, sort of like this mixed response from individuals, you know, who were like, but that's your culture, that's what you guys do at the Polynesian Cultural Center. You know, and so a lot of it is just, you know, really educating the community about that, but also, you know, letting the youth that I work with know that you can dance if you want to, but you don't necessarily have to, you know, because a lot of them feel like that they have bought into this idea that that is the way in which we perform culture, you know, and that is the only kind of representation that, you know, the society that we live in is comfortable with when it comes to who we are.
Yeah, and it gives white folks smiles. Not much else about being brown does, so that does.
Well, and again, there's a little sexual piece to that, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of uncovered skin and things like that. And so I want to go into that. I just have one more question, Aunt Pessy, and that is, what percentage of these youth that you're talking about, some who are saying I won't and things like that, do they all really know the dances, or are we now at this moment of this transition in time where, when they're losing that tie to culture, and especially, you know, as you talk about it being related to very specific occasions in, you know, marking life and moments in time?
Yeah, most of them really know the dances, and so they've grown up, you know, learning it for for specific family occasions, right? But of course, it's become, you know, even in high schools, it's become the cool thing, you know, that that's what they want to see too. So if there's a Pacific Island club or group, it's almost expected that you will do some kind of performance, because other than that, why do you need a Pacific Island club is sort of the, you know, wow. kind of like the narrative out there. And so there's always this expectation that, you know, you're creating this club because you guys are going to end up doing some kind of assembly that involves dancing, right? And so, yeah, and so it's really interesting to see some of the transition in that a lot of individuals, you know, a lot of the youth that I work with really feel like that that is such an important part. And if that's the only place that they can showcase culture in a safe, you know, safe space, then they'll do it. So it's a, you know, it's a paradox for many of them in that being sort of the only space in Utah that they could perform that within a mixed audience and be able to receive positive feedback, in a sense, you know, that it does make them smile. It does make people happy, you know, because the two main representations in Utah, it's either we're a dancer or we're criminals. And so many are like, well, I'd rather be the dancer stereotype than be the other, you know.
Wow.
One piece to add is I think it's important to distinguish between dancing for the entertainment of others who want to pay for this sort of caricature of culture and the really beautiful experience that comes in learning dances in a family. You know, that there's a cultural transmission that happens through dance, I think, that can be very valuable, but it has to be on your terms, you know, that it can be for your family or your own purposes apart from entertainment. And to go ahead and acknowledge that there's some real value in transmitting culture through dance, but not so that it can be, you know, displayed for others to buy.
I got to hop in here just for 1 second because I know we got important stuff to move on. But Gina, do you want to comment on the haka being used now, like football games versus a white people problem?
Yes, I think anybody who's from New Zealand will know how important it is because, in actual fact, our national religion isn't Anglicanism, it's rugby. And
I love it.
And the haka, of course, anybody who's seen the All Blacks has always performed, so it's become a really important national icon. Now, the backstory, of course, is that traditionally those haka would have been performed completely nude and with one's manhood standing at attention. And so when you tell, and this, the reason for the stance, you know, the crouching is to kind of show off all your tackle. And, you know, when you tell kind of.
We're learning some good, with some good euphemisms here. Yeah, I love it.
It's not really what I want to say.
Sorry.
So when you tell very prim, you know, Pākehā, they're quite horrified. And the other thing, of course, is that the particular haka is reasonably offensive to South Island Māori. It recounts heroically the acts of Te Rau Paraha, who had decimated various the Ngāi Tahu people in the South Island. So there's some kind of cultural politics going on around the way that that's used. But it's always interesting how kind of thrilled. I mean, I don't know how many times I've seen the haka being done. I mean, it's important. I endorse what Ana Pesi says and Luana, that the performance of those things are important for each other. And it's just the hollowing out of that so that we just become these kind of cultural creatures rather than kind of political creatures or, you know, that's really problematic.
Well, Gina, you know they do it. You know the BYU football team does it before every game.
Oh, wow. What haka do they use? Do you know?
I'm not discriminating amongst the hakas. I don't know that.
A lot of pounding of their biceps, and there's some crouching. And it was interesting. I've you know, at least during some sports night thing where they were kind of talking about it, you know, they were at least explaining what the language meant, you know, when they have this particular part of the chant, it says they're saying this and things like that. You know, and it felt like, it didn't feel quite as hollow and shallow, but there still is. I just can imagine, especially when it's non-Polynesian, non-Maori people doing it. There's got to be something there.
It kind of feels strange. I feel uncomfortable with people doing it, with non-Maori doing it outside of New Zealand.
It was like doing a quote-unquote Indian war dance before a football game. with the whole history of American Indian mascots. Kind of not cool, but I don't want to belabor this because we got things to move on to, but there it is.
One kind of cross between the images of dancer and criminal was the experience that some Utahns had in Roosevelt recently. Last year, there were some families at a high school football game who danced the haka and scared the locals and were pepper sprayed.
That's right. Yes.
And just last month, the Uinta County attorney issued an opinion saying that there was insufficient evidence that the officers had committed a crime, that there was a lot of confusion, but this assaulting of these haka dancers, that there were no charges filed, that, you know, everyone just got sort of scared is what the perception was. And I think that was kind of an interesting mix between, you know, you can be a dancer and a criminal, it turns out.
Well, I hope that stops.
Oh, man. Oh, thank you. Very interesting.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.